Ben. It's your turn to guess.
It's truly a chorus, isn't it? It's a mob of frogs.
I'm saying nothing. I don't want you to be winning. It's two each. Two each in the guessing the amphibian standings.
So I get absolutely no aid whatsoever.
Possibly the world's most difficult podcast-based game.
Certainly for us.
I'll give you a hint, if you want a hint. Do you want to have a little think, or shall I give you a hint?
Let's hear the hint.
All right, so the hint is, it's from the same country, crucially country, not state, as... Well, yeah, some overlap, but it's not from the state that the animals we're talking about later come from. Different state, same country. That was a confusing clue. They're also from America. That's what I should have said.
No, I understood your clue. It's all right.
Okay. I just kept talking and you weren't saying anything. You're hoping I'd say more. You're pulling a Louis Theroux on me. I'm watching you, son.
I mean, part of me just wants to guess something that would have sort of high densities in the States and sort of America, and I'm tossing it up between just going for like a good old fashioned wood frog, but I'm feeling like I'm gonna go American bullfrog.
Oh, it's a good guess. It's not the American bullfrog.
I bet the American bullfrog makes a really obvious sound that I'm super aware of and have heard.
Possibly, you know, it's kind of hard to know, isn't it? But yes, no, that was not. That was, in fact, the call of the Great Basin Spadefoot Toad.
Oh, Great Basin Spadefoot Toad, huh?
Yes. And the scientific name is Speyer intermontana.
Are they desert-dwelling, grassland-dwelling, digging toads, then? Spadefoots?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Nailed it. They're not massive. They're kind of chunky. You know, they're like probably about as long as your index finger would be, my guess, based on the pictures I've seen of them in the hand. And they're sort of mottled green. Sometimes they're quite bright green, quite chubby. Yes. Really beautiful, striking, massive eyes. Like, you know, like the hypno toad eye.
Yeah, those beautiful golden toad eyes.
Big style. Got that nice eye. And they, as the name would suggest, they have a spade foot. And they're an explosive, opportunistic breeder. Well adapted to unpredictable and harsh seasons typical of the high desert areas it inhabits in Western North America. So it's from Western North America, USA and Canada. Males aren't particularly territorial. They kind of clump together and call to females from near the shore of nice pools. They kind of have a bit of an explosive breeding vibe. You know, it's a mad scramble for mates as they arrive to these pools. And then after they've bred, the adults disappear underground and they use
dig their way back into the earth.
Exactly. They use the spades on their hind feet to burrow backwards into the soil, thereby avoiding water loss to the dry desert air. Tadpoles can be either herbivorous or carnivorous, depending on the local environmental conditions. They have two morphs. The carnivorous morph, they need to eat meat, has a massive head, larger jaw muscles, and this like really sharp keratinous beak for tearing and cutting flesh. Mm-hmm. The herbivorous ones are just more grazy boys. And the tadpoles develop really quickly and it helps them to avoid desiccation. And I think because the tadpoles develop quickly, may only lay relatively few eggs. You know, some amphibians are laying thousands. They're littering the whole area with them. Not so with these spadefoot toads. They lay between 10 and 40 eggs, which, yeah, develop quickly to avoid drying out.
So very purposeful and directed. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, they are. And one thing is also interesting about them, their scientific name, Speyer intermontana. So in Canada, Washington, and Oregon, they are actually sandwiched between the Cascade and the Rocky Mountain ranges. Yep. And that name, intermontana, means between mountains.
And they can't get out, no matter how hard they dig.
Mm-mm.
They'll never find their way through the mountains.
Yeah, they spade all the way down to the bedrock, and then they're stuck into Montana. And millions of years, they've been stuck into Montana. But yeah, pretty cool, and really, really nice toad. And yeah, nice call, but you didn't get it right, so it's still two each.
I feel no shame.
That's fine. So let's move on. So we have another episode for one of our Patreons. Thanks very much, Will. Will was interested in how being active either during the day or during the night can affect the processes and activities of lizards. And hopefully we found a paper here that should scratch the itch, that sort of difference between being active in the day and active in the night. We're doing it on one species. And Will is our Patreon, so got to choose the topic of this episode. And we have found this paper. It is by Taylor, Thorley, Pertuit, Dennis, Carson, Tang and Johnson, published in 2022, Artificial Night at Light Alters Diurnal and Nocturnal Behavior and Physiology in Green Anole Lizards, or as Ben would say, Green Anoles.
Anole.
Anole. this is published in Physiology and Behavior. All I could think about, because they have this acronym in this paper. Alan.
Yeah.
You know that little, you know, weird little, and he goes, Alan, 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 Alan. Do you remember that?
Wait, what are you talking about?
You know, there's that, like, what was it called? There was that TV show on BBC where they, like, dubbed voices over animals.
Right.
And it was, like, short. They were, like, five minutes.
Okay, that's what you're thinking. Okay, carry on.
Do you remember that, or am I losing my mind?
No, I have a vague memory of it. Yeah.
Okay. I thought you'd be like, yeah, I remember that.
No, I was disappointed because I thought where you were going was where I went when I heard Alan, and me, I'm just thinking of that horrific scene in Jurassic Park 3 on the plane where he's dreaming he's got a velociraptor chatting to him, waking him up.
Oh, yeah, after the plane crash.
Well, just before the plane crash, aye.
Oh, just before the plane crash.
No, it's before.
No, yeah, it's on the plane, isn't it? He has like a bit of a sort of premonition.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, that is spooky. Oh, no, I haven't seen Jurassic Park 3 for quite a long time, actually.
That's wise, yeah. Good idea. Mm,
yeah, it's the worst one. I think it's worse than the reimaginings of late. I would have said Jurassic Park 3 falls all the way down to the very bottom.
At that is there that much point making a differentiation?
Yeah, true. I don't know why they needed to invent new dinosaurs. So, Alan, what is it? Alan, artificial light at night. Basically, it's exactly that.
Streetlights. Light pollution sort of stuff.
Streetlights, yeah. Cities, you know, houses. Yeah, towns and cities produce a lot of it, but you don't have to be in a town or city. It just could just be a streetlight in the middle of nowhere. You know, that's artificial light at night. And it's known to have quite a lot of relatively major impacts on life, artificial light at night.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we, ourselves included, all animals, have a circadian rhythm, which is kind of fine-tuned over millennia, presumably, to, you know, react appropriately to the levels of light that animals receive. It's a key fundamental sort of cue for animals to behave in certain ways, and that goes down beyond actually like conscious behavior. That it can affect loads of different things to do with the kind of physiology when reproductive things develop, all this kind of stuff. It's known to suppress the daily production of melatonin, which is this what is that, a hormone? Melatonin.
Is a hormone. Sounds like it could be.
It's a hormone. And, you know, people take it after they've been on long haul flights to try and like get themselves back into the right circadian rhythm.
Oh, but really?
Yeah. My mum loves taking it after she's been on a flight. Huh. Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So if you have artificial light at night, it suppresses the daily production of this melatonin. And that is known from a variety of taxa, including perch, a fish, European blackbirds, and green anoles, which is the lizards we're talking about here, the little green lizards, and also humans ourselves. And artificial light at night can also cause dramatic disruptions to our sleep-wake cycles. And that has been shown in birds. So
yeah,
great tips.
Sleep disruption is just massively detrimental. I think the sort of books closed on determining that it's really bad and has lots of knock-on effects.
Yep, there's evidence. There's papers about it in rats and loads in humans. Yeah, like you say, working nights is known to abbreviate your life, unfortunately. In seasonal breeders, so animals which breed at a specific time of the year, usually based, you know, their phenology will be based around like the most opportune time to produce their young. And it, if you have artificial light at night, this can disrupt that. So it can cause early breeding in blackbirds. It can also cause a delay in the end of breeding, for example, in hamsters. And of course, if you're altering when an animal's reproducing, that's going to have dramatic effects on their ecology, on their behavior, and of course their reproduction in illuminated environments, including cities. And yeah, some animals have actually sort of adapted to artificial light to hunt at night. Day geckos are known to do that. A load of other geckos are known to do that. If you've been to a tropical country and been inside a building and looked up, you've probably seen some geckos scrabbling around. And yeah, they're doing...
They're making use of the short-circuiting of the insect navigation, right?
There was a paper about that recently, wasn't there? Yes. That basically insects are just completely bewildered by light because they use the night sky to navigate.
And right, and like... it sort of flips them upside down, so they get sort of short-circuited by it, yeah.
Right, we tried to avoid ridiculing insects. So yeah, diurnal insects, you've got me in an insect vibe now. Yeah, I think the geckos are slightly different though, aren't they? At least sort of your typical house gecko, that is a nocturnal species, which is exploiting light at night, which is different than a diurnal species exploiting light at night. It's a bit more of a dramatic shift, I feel, when you've got a diurnal species that would be active in the day, then switching to be active at night. So that's, I think that's what's cool about the day geckos, is there's this like plasticity to become nocturnal.
Yeah, and something like a day gecko has fewer of these like adaptations that you would associate with crepuscular animals. Like a crepuscular animal making use of the night more because of artificial light is kind of less dramatic than, like you say, a day gecko sort of completely flipping.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Crepuscular being dawn and dusk dwellers.
Yeah.
And yeah, so inevitably, as we always say, most of the research in this area has been done on mammals and birds, but that is starting to change. And here they looked at these little green lizards, the green anole, Anolis carolinensis. Well, they're not always green, are they? They're usually, males are green, mostly, females are browny. Mm-hmm. Sometimes lots of variation in between. And yeah, they were doing this research in Trinity University, which is an urban campus in San Antonio, Texas. And they basically had two groups of these anoles, two groups of 24, 12 males, 12 females in each group. And they were either exposed to a nocturnal light source, which mimicked how much light they would get living on the campus, which is quite cool. They actually went out and measured the light levels in the campus and then replicated that in the lab. So it's, you know, ecologically relevant amounts of light. And they compared a load of different facets of their behavior between the ones which were kept up all night with the lights and the ones which were allowed to have a normal day and night cycle. And yeah, they were looking to see if this introduced changes in their behavior both during the day and during the night. And they had a bunch of trials for these little lizards, didn't they?
Yeah, I think you've hit on the first important thing, is that the ones with the artificial light were more likely to be observed awake at night.
Yeah.
Yep. The controls were pretty much all sound asleep.
Yeah, as you'd expect. If you're not being illuminating them and it's time for them to sleep, they just go to sleep. But ones, should we just sort of fire off all the different things which they...
Yeah, so it's quite a sort of simple experiment, right? But really hits on the heart of the matter very nicely. Is you've just got your lizards with your artificial and you've lizards without the artificial light, and they've just measured a whole bunch of activities that they were doing or not doing, and have directly compared them, and job done, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think just fire them off and we'll go through them one at a time, and it will just be this list of differences or not differences.
Okay, yeah. So if the lizard was exposed to artificial light at night, they hid from light during the day more. Are you gonna go through by the figures?
Whichever order you'd like, mate. Whichever order you'd like.
Okay. Okay, yeah. So if they had artificial light at night, they're more likely in the day to hide from light, which suggests that, you know, they're trying to get some shut-eye during the day.
Exactly, trying to get some sleep that was disrupted during the night. Yeah.
Yes. If they were, similarly, if they're awake, if they've got the artificial light at night, in the day, they're slower to move. So it makes them, you know, less aware of what's going on.
Right.
Which is obviously kind of important if they get discovered during the day. They're just tired, probably. They don't really want to move around.
Yeah, they're knackered out from being up all night. This like muddying of their activity periods, I feel like they were less active than the controls during the day, more active than the controls during the night, but they were still sort of active during both.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like a complete flip to, okay, we're just night geckos now. It was just sort
animals.
Animals. It was just sort of like the softening of that barrier between night and day. It almost feels like a blurringness between that distinction.
I feel like that also adequately describes what happens to humankind when you make them work night shifts.
Right? It's just fuzziness.
Yes, neither is good. They're both, it's like, oh yeah, you finish your night shift at 6 a.m. You probably go home, have some food, but just sort of veg out, like battling with consciousness for a few hours. And then you sleep maybe till the early hours of the afternoon, get up, sort of zombie around for a bit, maybe have a bit more sleep. And then it's time to go back to work. You're not operating at full capacity. You're just sort of going through the motions. And yeah, like I think that does seem to be similar to what happened to the annals. But let's talk about what happened to the artificial light at night lizards at night, shall we?
Okay.
So at night, they're more likely to be awake because of the artificial light at night.
Mm-hmm. They're enabling them to be able to see.
Exactly, yeah. And they're visual animals. They're also quicker to move and more active at night if they've got light at night. Otherwise, they're...
Yeah, compared to the control, yes.
Compared to the control, sleepy lizards. They also perform, they do their displays, and they also consume more prey. If the lizards which had the normal day-night rhythm, they never, ever ate a cricket during the night, ever
once. Get indigestion.
Exactly. You're not going to wake up and eat just because it's there. You're asleep. Yeah. Whereas the ones which are awake because of this artificial night would actually hunt at night because of the artificial light. There are also some other things which are kind of interesting. So heavier balls. Heavier balls. The testes. The testes were heavier in the males which were kept up at night with artificial light. And they think that is because the growth and shrinkage of testes kind of, there's a cycle to it, right? They're breeding seasonally. And so they need the testes to be the biggest producing sperm when they need it in the sort of height of the breeding season. And then they sort of shrink away after that and become, because the lizards don't need them anymore for that year, so they don't need to be quite so big. And so what the authors think is that this additional light at night may have caused the annals' biological clock to actually think it was earlier in the year than it in reality was. So because of all this light, they're getting more light, and they think there's this longer photo period, not consciously,
basically like a longer day.
Exactly.
Right.
Mimicking spring rather than what might be like autumn.
Yeah.
And
so
that kind of means that, you know, the animal's biological clock is thinking, okay, right, it's earlier in the year, so I'm going to need more spermatozoa because I'm going to be breeding. Where in fact, actually, it might be later in the year. They're just mistaking it because of the additional light, which is kind of an interesting finding and something which has been seen in other species as well. They also stored fat slightly differently. So they weren't fatter generally, and they didn't grow more or less, but they stored fat. They stored fat in their bellies, which is like, you know, normally if an animal is using fat for like immediate resource energy, it will store the fat in the muscles where it can like quickly obtain it. Mm-hmm. But long-term fat storage occurs in like the belly. And they think that's because they were generally, you know, Ben, you were describing where they're kind of living in this sort of endless haze.
Like, that's what it sounds like. Yeah.
It's never the right time for them to be active.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, they're actually generally using probably less energy. They're less energetic.
Right, because it's all a bit sort of spread out and less intense. It's not got these bouts of like, okay, it's daytime, activity, let's go. Okay, sleep, no activity. Instead, it's sort of all middling activity and maybe overall less intense, but more sort of chronic.
Yeah. And so they started shifting and for storing fat in their bellies, which is probably an interesting consequence. And one other thing was that the males, which were subject to artificial light at night, performed their little push-ups, their push-bobs, and their dewlap displays, which are the way that animals communicate with each other. They did that more frequently than controls at night. And, you know, They also said that at night, actually the case was that the ones which had the normal day-night period would never display at night.
Well, they were asleep, weren't they?
They were asleep, yeah. Because basically green annals, they don't just display randomly. They only really display once they spot another lizard.
Yeah.
It's like a response to seeing another lizard. And obviously, if you don't have artificial light at night, you can't see the other lizards.
Yeah, who are you talking to?
Exactly, yeah. So they just don't. They
can't tell either.
Yeah, they don't know. So yeah, and this has also been seen apparently in several diurnal birds. So robins, blackbirds, great tits, and blue tits. So are probably four most common garden birds. Apparently, if they're exposed to artificial light at night, that means their auditory mating signals will sort of, they'll begin singing in the night instead of first thing in the morning, which sounds really annoying, to be honest.
It's less of a problem for them, though. You're, like you were talking about the whole visual thing with the animals. It's less of a big deal with the birds, because at least the other birds can still hear them.
Mm. Provided they're awake as well, yeah.
Yeah, well, they're going to be.
Yeah, they are. So am I. But when birds are singing, it sounds really annoying. I hope they don't start doing that a lot.
Screaming in your ear. You're going to wake up.
I mean, then I like all those calls, but I don't want them at night. But yeah, there, one other thing they talked about, which I thought was quite cool. Obviously, if you're going to have an annal, which is ordinarily active in the day, you know, it's evolved to be active in the day, the kind of the predators which it encounter should also, which it encounters should also, in theory, be active in the day. So you would think that by becoming nocturnal, or at least partially nocturnal, it would be sort of relieved from having to deal with its diurnal predators. However, there is at least one snake which is diurnal, and I don't think it overlaps with this species. It's just kind of an example they use. But the Puerto Rican racer, Boricanophis portoricensis, this snake has actually been shown to become nocturnal in response to artificial light at night.
Yeah.
As well.
I mean, this starts moving into a much more complicated scenario of day-night predator pressure, right? Because you're not only dealing with the predators that are present in the day and maybe some adaptable predators at night that haven't been had access to anoles before, and now they do. You've also got ones that might be shifting and basically following the anoles into this new nightlife. Yeah. Good luck.
So keep track of all of that. You could end up with a kind of weird double jeopardy where you've got all your old predators have followed you into the night, and then you've got the night ones that were there waiting. But
yeah.
I think crucially, the thing that it could have is quite a big impact on food webs, which is the sort of point they make in the paper. If all of these things are being disrupted.
I think that's precisely it. And potentially quite a difficult to predict impact on food webs too, because you're not really sure how night predators are going to interact with this novel prey. Well, or even anoles as predator as well. So it's got all of it. I mean, it reminds me of that paper talking about, I'm going to bring them up, cane toads.
And it's how been so many weeks. You did really, really well. You did really well.
These little ones were shifting their diurnal nocturnalness to avoid getting cannibalized by larger ones. So you'd
That's
have
crazy.
The day belong to the large adults and the night belongs to the tiny toadlets.
That's such an invasive species. That's such an invasive species thing to have happen. You just shift your own.
So successful that you've got to force a chunk of your population to make use of a time of day that you're not used to making use of, because they're going to get eaten by their own kind.
It's also torment for the people researching them, because, you know, you think if you're studying a nocturnal animal, you do your surveys at night.
Right.
So you can sort of rest during the day.
There
but
is
this
no
time.
Rest.
There is no rest, like,
the cane toads
because
are eternal.
You've got to look for, yeah, you've got to look for your juveniles in the day. Wow. That's wild. Yeah. Crazy. So there we go. I mean, artificial light at night, it causes carnage for the lizards and their behaviours.
It certainly is changing stuff. I think jury is not decided on whether a net negative, though, I would say. Because in some ways it's expanding a niche, isn't it? So who knows whether, you know, you've got some anoles that are good at adapting and making use of it. Maybe you've got some that are less so. But what you've essentially got is a population that's making use of maybe more, more niche. I like this is a silly way of putting it, but you know what I'm trying to get at. Like, they've got more options open to them in this artificial light scenario. If they can make that choice, if some of them can make that choice to exploit it and some of them can't, if they're just all forced into it, then maybe it's just going to be a muddy mess where they're all just constantly operating suboptimally. And it's a slow, tiresome demise. But I don't know.
Yeah. It's one of those ones. Kind of remains to be seen. It'd be interesting to know, like, if we could age reptiles adequately, then it would be really interesting to know if, like, these artificial light at night lizards are generally older or younger than other populations.
Something linked to stress could be interesting to see. Any sort of metric for like body mass index would be interesting. I mean, I know here they're showing that they're not heavier in total and not larger, but you know, maybe it takes a bit of time for those differences to pull out, because all their anoles they had were pulled from the campus. So they all will have experienced this artificial light in their day-to-day wild living. That's what I'm trying to say.
Is there any other kind?
Undead animals, who knows?
There we go. Artificial light at night. Annals. Have you got any other business this week?
I do not have any other business this week.
Okay. So I do. It's a bit of sad other business, actually.
Oh.
Did you hear about this person who got bitten by their pet Gila monster?
Vaguely. I might have seen a headline. I didn't look into it, to be honest.
So yeah, over in America, this guy had a Gila monster as a pet, which is famously one of relatively few venomous lizards. And
them and the bearded? No. Beaded.
Yeah. Yeah. And the Komodos.
And the Komodos.
Yeah. Yeah. And probably some others that we're either forgetting.
It's probably a few others. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, this Gila monster bit its owner and he died. Like I say, really sad. And it's a really unusual case because the man died really quickly, despite the fact that the venom of these lizards is usually not particularly dangerous to people. The last person to die of a Gila monster bite was around 1930. And it's thought that that individual actually had quite severe cirrhosis of the liver, which meant that they were basically really, really vulnerable to venom.
Only half on the venom, though, isn't it? Also, they have quite an inefficient venom deployment, right? It's not like a well-fanged snake. They've got to sort of gnaw on you to open up enough area for the venom to make its way in, as opposed to it being injected as such.
There aren't, like, fangs per se. Yeah. Yeah.
So they're not the most efficient venom delivery beasties.
No. But yeah, so this guy, he was only 34, and apparently after he was bitten, he stopped breathing and passed out really quickly, and sadly, died 4 days later. And it's just a bit of a mystery, really, as to why, whether or not there was an allergy involved or something along those lines. But
I mean, that would be my first instinct, would be to think those ways. But
yeah, or you know, like people do say that if you're like overexposed to venom, you can build up an allergy as well. Like I know that it's a thing for people who work in like venom extraction labs. They've got to be really careful not to like breathe in spitting cobra venom all the time, because they can develop a oversensitivity to it. Whether it's something along those lines, I don't know. But the individual Gila monster is now at the lab in the University of Northern Colorado, where its venom has been extracted and is now undergoing analysis. So they're going to determine whether or not there's anything unique. And I'd be amazed if there is. Amazed.
As if it's just a particularly weird hypervenomous Gila monster or something.
That was the impression I got from a news report. But that to me seems very unlikely.
They're overblowing that.
Well, actually, the reporting was actually quite sensible. I watched a video on CBS and it was like pretty measured. They had an interview with the researcher, this professor at the University of Northern Colorado, just saying like, yeah, we're going to extract the venom and see what's what. And I think also there's probably going to be some kind of post-mortem on the person to see what actually happened. But yeah, pretty crazy story. And like, at least from... I'm a member of a group on Facebook to do with Gila monsters and bearded lizards. And the discussion on there, it's the consensus. It seemed like so many people on there were like, yeah, I got bitten by one, nothing happened. So yeah, this really is a weird case. Like, yeah, people really don't usually die. But yeah, I just, that flashed up and I was like, wow, that's a pretty crazy story. So it'll be interesting to see if anything comes of those investigations into the venom. And certainly I'll keep my ear to the ground in that regard.
Yeah. That'd be, Who knows?
And yeah, one other, any other business. So we had a message from a listener called Ali. Ali said, my name is Ali, and I'm an occasional listener to the podcast. Okay, cheers, Ali. Came back full circle, though. But yeah, essentially, I think, yeah, in the episode we did on pied bull pythons, one of us wondered out loud if anyone actually ever guessed the episode's frog call correctly. And he said, I'm happy to inform you, this episode was the first time I ever guessed it correctly. I happen to know what Vietnamese mossy frogs sounded like because there's one... There's this one video of one calling that I see turning up in my social media feeds occasionally and sent the video.
Excellent.
And then he came full circle, Ali, came full circle. They came full circle and said, also, just letting you know, I really like the podcast. I'm a herpetologist myself. I'm currently doing a range-wide phylogeographic study of Nerodia fasciata for my master's. So, sweet. Nerodia fasciata. Good luck with that.
Okay.
That's the water snake in...
Yeah.
What's that? What's this hand signal?
It's my impression of a water snake eating a fish. In my mind, okay. I see that chubby little face.
Yeah, eyes on top of the head, like a little mini anaconda, a little freak.
Yeah, they're great.
Yeah,
they're lovely snakes. They're
cool snakes. They're good luck with the study. Yeah, so yeah, that's all I've got in terms of any other business. If you haven't got anything,
all good.
Okay, well, if you want to get in touch with us, you can. We are on social media. You can get in touch with us at herphighlights@gmail.com. Thanks again to our Patreon, Will, for choosing this topic. If you want to become a Patreon, you can. It's link in the show notes. And yes, all that remains to be said is see you next week, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening.